When Canadian Finance Minister Jim Flaherty tabled his government's budget last month, he stated his aim to eliminate the federal deficit by the 2015-2016 fiscal year. Will that focus on balancing the country's books, along with other initiatives in the budget document, help or hurt Canada's economic recovery? We'll hear a perspective from senior economist David MacDonald of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. And later, what evidence is there that Canada, the United States, and other developed countries are contemplating the same appropriation of depositors' assets as was recently used to bail out the Cypriot banking sector? We'll hear an assessment from author and civil litigation attorney Ellen Brown about the Cypriot precedent and what alternatives can be explored to salvage the economy in the face of ailing banks that are too big to fail. On today's program, the Canadian budget and the Cyprus precedent. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 11th, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website at globalresearch.ca. We are also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with some of the major stories shaping the national and international political landscape. Venezuelan government officials are alleging that the Venezuelan opposition is employing Central American mercenaries to destabilize the country in the lead-up to the April 14th presidential election. At an April 6th campaign event, interim president Nicolás Maduro explained that the U.S. officials Otto Reich and Roger Noriega, together with right-wing groups in El Salvador and Venezuela, linked to opposition candidate Capriles, backed the plan to dispatch the mercenaries. The goals of the alleged maneuver were threefold: sabotage the power grid, increase murders in the country, and kill incumbent Maduro. Shortly after Maduro's announcement, his foreign minister Elias Jawa said that the country's intelligence agencies had clandestinely recorded conversations between retired Salvadoran Armed Forces Colonel David Koch Arana and right-wing Salvadoran politician Roberto Dabuisson, in which the plan was discussed. Jawa says the plot is part of a larger strategy to delay an election the opposition will not likely win. That comes to us from Venezuela Analysis. North Korea is signaling it is serious about launching missiles in coming days. Last week, Pyongyang warned foreign diplomats they had until April 10th to evacuate their post. On Tuesday, it advised foreign nationals to leave South Korea, warning of an imminent thermonuclear war. South Korean intelligence had detected two mid-range missiles on the east coast of North Korea were being prepared for launch. The medium-range Musudan missiles can reach Japan and the U.S. island of Guam. In addition, Japanese military sources confirmed the presence of up to seven ballistic missiles of varying range on mobile platforms on the North's east coast. Japanese military sources said in Tokyo, these missiles can be launched anytime, either in succession or simultaneously. The South Korean government has appealed to Russia and China to use their influence with the North to reduce tensions. The South Korea-U.S. Combined Forces Command have raised their WatchCon status from 3 to 2. WatchCon 1 represents wartime status. That comes to us from the Voice of Russia. The Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, is saying that shoddy workmanship in the installation of leak detectors may have been to blame for the spillage of contaminated water from the number 2 and number 3 underground storage tanks at the Fukushima number 1 nuclear plant last weekend. The utility explained that while the cause of the leak has yet to be determined, it suspects that improper sealing of the water shielding sheets around where the leak detectors are fitted could have resulted in a hole opening up under the weight of the water. TEPCO has built facilities to contain 325,000 tons of radioactive water, and which, as of April 8th, already hold 270,000 tons. A TEPCO official stated that the more heavily damaged number 2 storage tank is being given top priority, and water stored there is being moved to the number 1 and number 6 storage tanks. TEPCO says cement mixed in with the soil around the tanks will prevent radioactive water from spreading extensively, but warns that the entire area could be contaminated if leaked water mixes with groundwater. That comes to us from Asahi Shimbun. According to a draft assessment of Cypriot financing needs prepared by the European Commission, Cyprus intends to raise 400 million euros from the sale of its excess gold reserves in order to help finance its part of the bailout. This money would be in addition to the 10.6 billion euros it would recoup from the winding down of the country's second largest bank, Laiki, as well as the liquidation of assets from junior bondholders and of uninsured depositors under the deposit for equity swap. Nicosia would raise a further 600 million euros over 6 years by increasing corporate income taxes and rates on capital gains. The assessment said that of the 23 billion euros of financing needs before the first quarter of 2016, the Eurozone Bailout Fund would supply 9 billion euros, the IMF 1 billion, and Cyprus itself 13 billion euros. And that comes to us from Reuters. On March 21st, Canada's Conservative government tabled their 2013 budget. Finance Minister Jim Flaherty's document, titled Jobs, Growth, and Long-Term Prosperity, Economic Action Plan 2013, emphasizes, among other things, a focus on balancing the country's books by the 2015-2016 fiscal year, new skills training and infrastructure programs, and the closing of tax loopholes. While these and other measures may sound responsible, groups such as the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives have argued that when one digs deeper, the measures in Flaherty's fiscal blueprint will do the opposite of its stated goals. To take us through the numbers, we're joined on the line by David MacDonald. He's a senior economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and he also coordinates the research group's annual alternative federal budget. So, David MacDonald, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, now, first of all, do you want to make just a little bit of background on the CCPA itself? I mean, you've been organizing these alternative federal budgets for some time now. Is there a specific focus that the CCPA has when they put together their assess their priorities for what the federal government should be putting forward?
Yeah, as you say, the alternative federal budget is a long-running project for the CCPA. This was its 19th year. Started actually during the Martin cuts of the 1990s. And it's a big project. We have over 90 contributors this year, 27 different chapters, each one of those chapters looking at a different area. And so it's quite a complete document. I mean, our goal is not only to make specific policy recommendations for each one of those chapters, but also to figure out ways that we can pay for some of these things through new taxation measures and changing the tax code and so on. And so in this year's budget, one of my big concerns is this ongoing issue of slow growth. So we're not in a recession, but we're not seeing the same kind of strong rebound that we have seen in previous recessions, where growth picks right back up after we pop out of the recession. And this isn't a short-term problem. It's actually a longer-term problem. It's continued for the last couple years, and from the economic projections to date, looks like it's going to continue for several more years to come.
It seems as if it seems as if in your critique of the budget that the emphasis is overly on deficit reduction, and that's maybe and not enough on growth, on stimulating growth, as you say. Is it really are the two kind of diametrically opposed in that sense?
Well, They are, in the sense that Canada doesn't have a deficit problem, it has a growth problem. Deficits at the federal level are so small that, economically speaking, they're not of any particular concern. In fact, over the past couple of years, despite the fact that we've been running some small deficits, the, the debt burden is actually going down. Our debt to GDP ratio is going down. And so from an economic perspective, the federal deficits are really not an issue. I think that where they are an issue is from the political perspective, that the conservative government has committed to balancing the budget by the next election. But more importantly, they've said that they won't introduce major new measures until the budget is balanced. And so the next election, which will likely be in 2015 at some point, that's really the goal. It's not that there isn't an economic imperative to balance the budget by 15-16, but there's definitely a political imperative to do so, so that by that time they can promise big tax cuts for wealthy families, probably through income splitting and expanding TFSAs.
Now, I think perhaps the whole austerity program, the way it's couched in such a way as to resonate with people who are maybe organizing their own household budgets, who understand that you have to live within your means, you can't spend over more than what you take in, and so, you know, for a household, deficits are a big issue. But when you're talking governments, it's a different situation, isn't it? That
sure. For a household, you can cut back and you save some money. And if you cut back, that's not going to affect your neighbors. It's not going to affect the economy because you're such a small piece of the puzzle. But when you get governments, particularly the federal government and some provincial governments, when they start cutting back, they are a big piece of the economic puzzle. And they employ people directly and indirectly. They drive economic growth. They're often counter-cyclical, which means that when the economy is doing badly, governments will spend a bit more through automatic programs like EI, for instance, or at the provincial level, other income support programs. And so governments automatically often act as a support program for the economy. But when we're looking at a period of slow growth, we see consumers in Canada are heavily indebted at this point. Debt to disposable income ratios hitting all-time highs almost every quarter, now at about the level of where the Americans were in 2006 when their housing crisis hit. Businesses are relatively well-placed, but they won't spend until they see strong economic growth. And so corporations in Canada are now sitting on what's approaching $600 billion, with a B, in cash in their bank accounts that they are unwilling to spend because they don't see economic growth growing fast enough. And so when you've got those two key groups in the economy and weak exports due to what's happening in the U.S. and Europe, then overall the economy isn't growing very quickly because no one's driving that growth, no one's driving that recovery. In that type of circumstance, governments can play a very critical role in terms of, first of all, building things that we need anyway, things like infrastructure, for instance, or building social programs that can be useful for Canadians anyway, and doing it at a time when interest rates are at all-time lows. So we'll never see interest rates this low, probably for a generation. And so governments can use their leverage to borrow at incredibly low interest rates and build repair cities, repair wastewater systems, build new transit systems, and do it at costs that are at all-time lows. So governments can play a key role in pushing against slow growth. Unfortunately, the more austerity we see, the more we continue to see a slow growth environment.
Well, there are certain spending initiatives, and you can maybe tell us what you think of them. They're talking about, for example, I believe $900 million in spending to support jobs and growth. There's also a $14.4 billion infrastructure fund starting in 2014, extended over 10 years, although much of that money is what you call back-ended, so it's not going to be, most of it is going to be spent later rather than earlier. So could you talk about those sorts of spending initiatives and how, I guess you just touched on it with the interest rates about the infrastructure spending, but I do know that infrastructure was a major concern in your critique. Do you want to maybe take that on?
Yeah, what's happening at the federal level is there's what's called the Building Canada Fund. Now, the Building Canada Fund, let's call it the old Building Canada Fund, expires at the end of next year. And it was a seven-year program, spent a fair amount of money, and provided a good long-term source of funding for cities. Now, it's currently spending about $1.25 billion a year on city infrastructure. What's going to happen, though, in 2015 is that it's going to go from spending $1.25 billion to spending $250 million. So it'd be about a $1 billion cut in the amount that's being spent on infrastructure in 2015. Now, it starts from that new base. Now it's called the new Building Canada Fund. It starts from that new base and then ramps up. And by 2020, it hits its new peak, which is going to be $2 billion a year, up from $1.25 billion, which is what it'll be in 2014. But what's interesting about the, you know, the $14 billion figure is it's spread out over a long period of time. And in fact, 75% of all of the money in this new infrastructure fund is going to be spent on or after 2020. So it's really something that's a long ways into the future, and it's unlikely that the finance minister, for instance, or even the prime minister will still be in their positions at that time. And so I think that, you know, they're pushing these big investments off so far into the future that it's questionable whether we'll see them at all. Now, had this schedule been reversed, and we'd seen $2 billion a year putting into infrastructure today, I think that actually would have been fairly positive. I mean, it would have been a step in the right direction to really supporting infrastructure in the communities and driving economic growth, importantly. So whereas we may see a big boost in infrastructure spending in 2020 and the employment impacts that come with it, we don't need more employment in 2020. We need more employment today when interest rates are low and unemployment is high.
Especially youth unemployment.
That's right. And so, you know, these projects could be much more tied to employing youth, for instance, or supporting the trades for working in them. Those could be some of the requirements of these projects. And so maybe that brings us to one of the second big initiatives in this budget, which is this new skills Canada Job Grant Program. And so this is a change in how employment insurance, training money is spent. When the Conservatives took power in 2006, they actually devolved most of the EI training to the provinces and let them administer the programs how they wanted, because the provinces already administer a lot of job training programs, and so it made some sense to do that. The federal government now appears to want to pull that money back to Ottawa, but do it in a very specific way. What they want is to have a grant of up to $15,000 per student. And the way it would work is that it would be a job training program where the feds would put in a third, the provinces would put in a third, and employers would put in that final third. And if any one of those three parties decided they didn't want to do this, then they wouldn't get the money. I mean, one of the problems with this approach as it stands today is that the requirements are quite loose. And so what that probably will mean is that employers who already do job training will get a whole bunch of extra money for doing something they already do. And for employers that don't do job training, and this is actually a fairly serious problem in Canada, CEOs want to complain all day about the skills gap, but they don't want to train their own employees to fill it, and they don't want to hire new people and train them to fill the skills gap. So they complain about it, but they don't want to spend any money on it. And so one of the big problems with it is that because it requires employers to put up a portion of the money, they just may not put up the money, and therefore, you know, with one of those key pieces missing, then you don't get the money flowing at all. So, I mean, I think it is positive to some degree that the finance minister is saying to the CEOs that are complaining, look, you're going to have to put some money on the table. And so we'll have to wait and see whether this actually entices employers to do anything more, or whether it's just a significant deadweight loss where we're transferring a whole bunch of money to employers that are doing job training in any event.
Now, I know that another aspect of the budget, there's a renewal of $1.25 billion funding over 5 years for the P3 Canada Fund and the public-private partnerships.
Yeah, this is a renewal, again, of a program that existed prior to this budget, and so that they're taking a program and putting some more money into it. The problem is that this type of program isn't particularly useful for municipalities. The take-up rate was poor in the first version of it. Only about 30% of the original billion and a quarter money was spent. About 50% of it's been allocated, only about 30% of it's been spent. And so the take-up rate has been relatively poor. And it's because communities, for the most part, I mean, if you're fixing a road, you can't really use that for a P3. You're fixing a wastewater system, that's not a P3. You can sometimes do it for transit. Sometimes you can do it for recreational facilities. But oftentimes you hand away a lot of control over how these projects are implemented to some private company that's running them. And And most of the time, municipalities don't want to hand over all this control just to get some extra funding and lose control of their own facilities. But the take-up rate, unfortunately, has been poor. I think this is an important ideological issue for the conservatives, and that's why they're putting more money in it. But from the community's perspective, or in terms of actually driving job growth, the returns have been poor on this type of program. Mm.
Now, on the positive side, and I do see a bit of a convergence between your own alternative budget and the conservative budget, and they're talking about recouping $400 million in revenue from closed tax loopholes and enforcement. That's something that you were promoting in the alternative budget, were you not? Well, not
sure. I mean, I think
in principle, at least.
In principle, this is definitely a good approach. The tax sheets, everyone should have to pay their taxes. That should not be an optional issue. I mean, one of the issues here is that at the same time that they want to collect all this additional money through tax loopholes and a line so you can snitch on your neighbors, they've cut a significant portion of the staff at CRA that would do this type of inquiry. And so, you're talking a bit out of both sides of your mouth. One of the problems with this approach, which is a very piecemeal approach, is that it doesn't actually tackle some of the big tax loopholes that are legal. Most of these new changes are, charging GST on people parking in hospital parking lots and that sort of thing. But some of the big tax loopholes, for instance, if you're paid in stock options, you get, you're taxed at a lower rate. Companies can write off their meals and entertainment, for instance. These are big tax loopholes that are legal, and closing them would raise a significant amount of money. Now, of course, the corporate sector wouldn't like that very much because they can't pay their executives at a lower tax rate through stock options. But, I think that what's being addressed in this budget is really small potatoes compared to some of the bigger tax expenditures, as they're called by the government reports, that we could address, and we could raise a lot more money that way.
Now, standout element of the budget, it seems to me, is the folding of CEDA, the Canadian International Development Agency, into the Foreign Affairs and Trade portfolio. Mm-hmm. Now, it seems as if our aid and development budget is already linked to some extent to our foreign policy agenda. So, I mean, is this problematic, really? I mean, either politically or economically?
I don't think folding CETA back into DFAT necessarily is a negative move. Oftentimes there's a lot of overlap. I mean, we should note that our overseas development aid has been capped at $5 billion, and so we're nowhere near the goal that Pearson set for us in terms of spending 0.7% of our gross national income on, or gross national product rather, on overseas development. And so, I mean, I don't think the folding in necessarily is a problem. It's just a question of whether CETA's mandate changes from, supporting people most in need to supporting Canadian companies' commercial interests. So, for instance, in mopping up after a Canadian mining company comes in and makes a mess of a local economic situation. I mean, that would be very troubling, and there is some signs that that's where we're going, that CETA is just going to be an arm of Canadian commercial interest as opposed to it being devoted to helping poor countries develop and gain access to clean water and health care the way it should be. So that, I think, is a developing story, and we'll see over time whether the folding in is just a first step towards increased commercialization of CETA or whether it's purely an administrative move.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so maybe talk a little bit about your alternative budget or the alternatives that you would propose in order to not only, stimulate the growth that you were talking about, as well as to improve the job situation and otherwise restore prosperity for the nation.
We had a much heavier focus on infrastructure, and as I said earlier, as we were talking about what the government has done, I think that had they reversed that schedule and put a lot more of that infrastructure spending up front, it would have been a fairly positive move for the country now, as opposed to in 2020, when a lot of this money is going to, when the peak of the program is going to be hit. So the alternative federal budget had a strong focus on infrastructure spending, but it also had a strong focus on supporting Canadians at lower income brackets, whether it's through supporting seniors or families with children that live in poverty, and trying to reduce the absolute levels of poverty. And it wasn't just about infrastructure poverty levels, but also about new social programs that could be beneficial for all Canadians, things like $10 a day child care that we're seeing in Quebec. These are programs that the federal government can play a role in encouraging this type of thing across the country, as well as some new investments in health care, for instance, in trying to reduce the long-term costs and through increasing programs like home care and support for primary health care. And the other thing, too, is we didn't shy away from how we might pay for some of these items. So one of the new pieces this year that we introduced was starting to take a serious look at tax havens and their utilization by corporations so that they make the money in Canada, but they don't pay the tax in Canada. They move that money overseas and skip the tax man here in Canada. And so we had a new withholding tax that would kick in for tax havens to encourage companies to pay the tax that they should be paying on this on these incomes. And we also had a much bigger focus on tax loopholes. Now, these are legal tax loopholes, as opposed to the government focusing on more enforcement issues, and trying to close some of the more egregious tax loopholes so that corporations, mostly corporations, are paying a fairer rate and have less options to hide their money elsewhere and skip the tax man in Canada.
Could I ask you, David McDonald, in your experience, when it comes to a budget like this one and austerity budgets generally, who is the biggest beneficiary?
Well, I mean, at this point, we're moving towards rapidly balancing the budget. I published a report just yesterday that looked at what some of the staff impacts were of austerity budgets since 2011. Just to see whether these staff cuts were spread proportionally, whether particular departments that saw really big hits. And it turned out that these were not across-the-board cuts of 8%, for instance. They were, in fact, heavily targeted to particular departments. Veterans Affairs, for instance, losing a quarter of its staff. Aboriginal Affairs losing 1 in 5 of its staff. HRSDC losing a quarter of its staff. And then when you can look down and see what the programs are that are being affected. For Veterans Affairs, it's the health care program and death and disability benefits for veterans. It's not the back office in most cases. At Revenue Canada, it was the back office that was being targeted. But in most of the big departments where you're seeing these big cuts, those cuts are coming from program lines that deliver services. And so from that perspective, it's Canadians that access these services that are going to be affected. It's going to be harder for them to talk to an actual person. Regional offices are being closed. So if you're a veteran and you're trying to get your death or disability benefits, or you're a widow of a veteran, for instance, it becomes harder to do that because there are just less people processing those forms. We've already seen some of the impacts in EI, where the wait times have gotten to extreme levels. It's extremely difficult if you've got any problem with your EI benefits because you lost your job. You can't talk to someone, so you need this money now, and it takes months for your application to be processed. So it becomes much more challenging if you need to use these services, talk to a real person to sort your problem out. On the other side of things, some of the real benefits of these cuts will likely go, I mean, it depends on how the next election goes, but if the Conservative government policies will be implemented, the major benefits of austerity now will likely go to upper-income households through programs like income splitting and increasing the tax-free savings accounts, which would disproportionately benefit higher-income households. Now, these policies haven't been implemented yet, but this is the goal of austerity, is to take money out of the system now so that we'll get surpluses more rapidly, and those can be transformed into tax cuts. And those tax cuts will go out largely to higher income households.
David McDonald, thank you very much for that overview of this budget.
Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with David McDonald. He is senior economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and the coordinator of the CCPA's Alternative Federal Budget. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. The prospect of major banks confiscating the savings of their depositors and using them to bail out the banks is not apparently just a one-off remedy for the struggling Cypriot banking sector. Apparently, similar moves have been explored for New Zealand, the UK, and the USA. Global Research has also published articles describing the plan for Canada being explicitly announced as part of the Canadian government's recent budget package. The so-called bail-in package is being promoted as an alternative that protects taxpayers, but is this new scheme an improvement to TARP-style bailouts? What are the underpinnings of the current fiscal crisis, and how could it be remedied with minimal risk to the wider public? Joining us to discuss these questions, we're joined by Ellen Hodgson-Brown. She is a Los Angeles civil litigation attorney, chairperson of the Public Banking Institute, and the author of 11 books, including Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. Her websites are webofdebt.com and ellenbrown.com. So thank you for joining us, Ellen Brown.
Thank you, Micah.
Okay, so I know that you've commented in a recent article on Global Research. It's called It Can Happen Here, the Bank Confiscation Scheme for U.S. and U.K. Depositors. Could you maybe just help us, walk us through a little bit, precisely how the Cypriot banking sector found itself maneuvered into this situation where depositors actually face the prospect of losing their savings to the banks themselves?
Well, in Cyprus, they had two large bankrupt banks, which interestingly actually passed the stress test a couple of weeks before they were declared hopelessly bankrupt. So it looks suspiciously to me like a test case. And we see evidence that this plan has been around for quite some time, at least since 2010. In the case of Cyprus, they were told by the IMF, the EU, and the ECB that they could not get any more money for a bailout unless they did this bail-in plan. They would have to go. They would have to do a haircut on their own depositors. So, for insured depositors, it was a smaller haircut, 6-point-something%. And then for the uninsured depositors, over 100,000 euros, it was a larger haircut. And the people took to the streets. They protested. Absolutely not. They were, it wasn't fair to make the depositors pay. And so the legislature voted it down, which was very bold, I thought. But then they were at risk of being eliminated from the EU, and their economy would be destroyed. So they knuckled under and agreed to they saved the insured depositors under 100,000 euros. But anybody over 100,000 euros got really substantial haircuts. Originally it was 40%, but now I think it's up to 60%. They're not exactly haircuts. Their money is turned into stock.
And
so,
it's
basically a debt for equity swap. So it's a way to capitalize the banks by using the depositors' money.
Yeah, and as we've seen with the 2008 banking crisis, stock is not necessarily the most secure thing in the world.
Right. No, if you had Lehman Brothers stock, you'd be wiped out, and these would be the equivalent of Lehman Brothers, these quite bankrupt banks. In fact, I think this is the Lehman moment where this is the point where they said, no more, governments aren't going to bail out the banks, so you're going to have to save yourselves. I mean, they shouldn't be saved at all. It's all a ploy to keep the big banks alive no matter what, as if it's more important to keep these too big to fail banks alive than to preserve their depositors, who theoretically is the whole point of being a bank, in order to have a safe place to put your money and to be able to write checks and, do do all those normal things that banks do. But instead, the too big to fails are the ones that are gambling and derivatives, and that's the reason they're in trouble in the first place. But these whole bailout schemes are set up to preserve their derivative schemes, preserve their gambling, and to hit up the depositors for the capital when they lose and it depletes their required capital. Then these schemes allow them to convert depositor money into capital. And the reason they can get away with it legally, I guess, is that there's law going back at least to the mid 19th century saying that when you put your money into the bank, it becomes the money of the bank. The bank has the money, and you just have an IOU, so you become a creditor. So they can call us unsecured creditors, which to me makes no sense. It seems to me that we're 100% secured because we put up 100% of the money, unlike the derivatives players who only put up some portion for their collateral. But they're considered secured, and we're considered unsecured. And that's the major problem, is that under the bankruptcy laws in the U.S. since 2005 and under Dodd-Frank, the derivatives players go first in a bankruptcy. They get to collect their money before the depositors do. Well, if you have the big vulnerable ones in the U.S. right now are J.P. Morgan and Bank of America. They both have more in derivatives than the entire global GDP. So J.P. Morgan has $79 trillion in derivatives, and Bank of America has $76 trillion. And they are on the, well, on the low interest side of the interest rate swaps. J.P. Morgan's big, they're the big interest rate swap player. And interest rate swaps are 80% of the derivatives market, which altogether is something like $600 trillion. So they're at risk if interest rates go up at all, and that's one reason that the Fed keeps them at these ridiculously low levels. But if they go up at all, then J.P. Morgan is the counterparty that has to pay out. They're like the insurer that has insured these interest rates, and so they've just sat back and collected all these fees all this time. But at some point, they're going to have to pay the piper, and that's what the concern is. The derivatives players are going to therefore get their money out first, and in the event of a big derivatives bust, there's just not going to be anything left for the depositors.
It sounds like we've got like a huge, I'm envisioning this huge set of dominoes that have been set in place. And then I guess the first domino would be where a default happens in relation to these derivatives. I know that if I go to a bank to get out a loan, I have to provide some kind of collateral that shows that I'm good for that loan, but it sounds as if the derivatives, the situation with the derivatives, there is no such thing as collateral. Am I right about that, or?
Well, is that they do require collateral for derivatives, and when things change, then they raise their collateral requirements, and that's one thing that could deplete their capital. They have to use their capital to put up that collateral. But it seems to me, when we put our $100 in the bank, that's $100 collateral as far as I'm concerned, but they don't count that. They say, no, that's our money. You've given us your money. We've given you an IOU. Mm. There's no collateral.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think probably most people labor under the belief that is, you know, that's my money in the bank, not the bank's money. But
I would call that fraudulent omission at best, because they certainly never make it clear that it's their money.
Is it in the fine print or something?
Well, I'm wondering. I was thinking I was going to check that too, but I doubt it's very explicit. You know, you can't really understand legalese. I'm a lawyer, and it's designed to not be understood, and especially the fine print in those contracts. But fine print in contracts has legally been held to be fraudulent. You know, you're supposed to make important points clear to the people on the other side of the contract. So,
okay.
Contract of adhesion, you're forced into it, and you don't really know what you've been forced into.
Now, I know that in the Canadian situation, the government's document, Jobs, Growth, and Long-Term Prosperity Economic Action Plan 2013, and there's a short segment that says that it talks about a bail-in program. I think it's pages 144 and 145. They don't mention the word confiscation, but it does seem as if we're looking at the same sort of situation where a Canadian, you know, can see their deposits into their bank accounts being used in an unlikely scenario where they should be required to have that that collateral, if you will, or that where the banks should require those assets.
But I'm guessing it's very likely, because that's why they're going to the trouble of setting up these provisions everywhere. It goes back to the Financial Stability Board that we all signed on to in 2009, which is part of the BIS, you know, it's under the Bank for International Settlements. The G20 nations all signed on to it. The Bank for International Settlements is the global bank regulator. I mean, now it used to be just a guidelines, but now with the Financial Stability Board, that it's mandatory. So they came out with some sort of directive that said everybody was supposed to have these bail-in provisions, or they're called open resolution, I guess, policies. How to resolve? The idea is to resolve the too big to fails without getting rid of it. In other words, how to keep the too big to fails afloat when the governments are no longer willing to pay to bail them out. I mean, obviously the government's been pushed as far as they're going to go. You could see that in Cyprus, and you could see that in the EU, where the Dutch finance minister said this is going to be the pattern for, I forget what word he used, but anyway, the blueprint for future bailouts, that they will go after the depositors' funds. Now, he said that the insured depositors would be protected, but in the U.S., for example, we have a directive called the FDIC, Bank of England Directive. That's what I was writing about. It's totally legalese, so you can't really tell what they're saying, but they say that the uninsured creditors the unsecured creditors will be bailed in, and they'll have to do their part. So to the extent that there's not enough capital in one of these major black swan type losses, then the debt will be converted to capital or equity, including the debt of the unsecured depositors who include, I'm sorry, the unsecured creditors who include the depositors. And they never say that the insured depositors will be protected, and it's only the uninsured depositors that they're going to go after. They don't make that distinction, and we know that they've taken the depositors' money before, because they took it in the Washington Mutual bankruptcy. They took the uninsured depositors. They gave them a haircut or took some of their money.
Now, I'm wondering how these sorts of maneuvers impact on the public. I know that it seems to me that wealthier, you know, investors, they probably are seeing the writing on the wall here, and they're going to take some efforts to protect themselves. Do you see a prospect of maybe the less affluent or less informed people being adversely impacted by this haircut?
Well, it's certainly what happened in Cyprus. That the big players, the Russian oligarchs, etc., they managed to get their money out in large part because the Russian branch and the London branch of those two banks were kept open longer than the Cyprus branch. So they could pull their money out after after they got notice that all this was happening. And as you say, well, it seems to me that most large investors don't keep their big money in a bank. They put it in something else, like the stock market or commodities, or they buy something, you know, buy real estate or something like that. So it's the people who do keep their money in bank accounts or most of their money in bank accounts, those are the people who, that's all the money they have, and they need it to write their checks. I mean, they're living month to month, and that's their living money. And also, you could, the money over 100,000 euros in Cyprus included pension money. So this is ordinary people's money, but it's all pooled together in a pension fund. So it looks like big money, but really it's a bunch of it's little money for a lot of ordinary people. So they took those, and there are people that just can't get the money to, like small businesses, they can't get the money to pay their workers, so the workers don't have any paychecks. So it just was already wreaking havoc on the economy, and the same thing could happen here.
It seems to me that the prospect of people, and you're painting this as a likely scenario that people will have their funds confiscated in this way. That sounds much more severe than a tax bailout. And with people losing their money, I mean, it seems to me they're going to be spending less, and you're going to be catapulting into another major recession, if not a full scale depression. No.
Well, actually, it's the government is the only entity that can afford to bail out the banks, and it could do it just by printing the money. The government, or at least certainly our government, has that power. Cyprus government doesn't. They could just print the money and bail out the banks, but there is no point in doing it if the banks are going to continue with all this gambling. What you have to do is nationalize the banks. If we, the people, are going to bail the thing out, we should get the profits. We should have control of what the bank does. It should be doing conservative, prudent banking in the people's interest, not a lot of gambling that actually, takes profits from the people in all these derivatives schemes that are really just, they really are literally just bets. That's all they are, and they're betting against us quite often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that in your book Web of Debt, you pretty much explain the underpinnings of this whole fiscal mess, ultimately being founded on the fact that banks can lend out money that they basically create money every time they lend out to someone. It's just a bookkeeping entry that has to be repaid with interest, and so that, and you end up with a whole situation where the bulk of the money in our supply actually was created out of thin air. So when you propose this nationalization strategy and the idea of the government printing up money, is that a way of undermining that whole situation? I mean,
No, I think it would be a way of taking it over. It's a good thing to have the ability to get credit. Creditworthy borrowers should be able to get credit. And if you put a lid on it and you say, well, like let's say it was a gold system, and if there was no gold in the bank, you couldn't get a loan. That would definitely put a damper on productivity. But what we need to do is acknowledge that that's what banking is. It's merely credit. It's merely an advance of credit. And it's our credit. It's the full faith and credit of the United States. So it should be a public entity, basically just a clearing house or the function of the bank. Let's assume a public bank, the function of which is to assess the creditworthiness of borrowers and turn their credit into a fungible piece of paper or other form of money that they can spend into the economy that people recognize as money. And then so the function of the bank is to put their stamp on it and say, we'll stand behind this. And if the borrower doesn't pay, I mean, you do charge interest in order to cover the defaults and to cover your operation costs. But that's all you need to do in the way of interest, and the interest should go back to that entity, which should be a public entity, and it should have nothing to do with derivatives. I mean, if you have people that want to gamble, they should be gambling with their own money and definitely not with the money of people who think they put it in the bank because it was safe there.
Mm. Would you, it seems to me that there have been a few arguments against nationalization, typically leveled. Is there some sense in which, if you leave it to a governing entity to, like, if you effectively hand control over to a state government or a federal government, does that, you know, introduce the prospect of abuse for?
I'm just writing a book on that, which I'm almost finished with. There are two recent studies that showed that public banks globally, 40% of banks are publicly owned. These are largely in the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, which all of which escaped the credit crisis, and they did it largely because of this public banking system. They don't have time to fool around with speculation and, you know, supporting this usurious, parasitic financial industry that's sucking profits out of the economy. They use their credit for productive purposes, and they recycle it back to the government, which actually does represent the people far more than our banking system. And our banking system doesn't even pretend to be trying to work for the economy. They're working for their shareholders, and everybody knows that. So these two recent studies found that public banks were less corrupt than private banks, and that they were also actually more profitable, and they were definitely safer. So in places like Russia, where they toyed with going to private banks in the 1990s, and then they had the Asian crisis, and a lot of depositors got wiped out, and so now they're afraid of the private banks, and so they've moved back into the public banks. The public banking sector is totally dominates Russia now because they work better. They're safer, and they have the guarantee of the government, and therefore they can make, you know, more loans more efficiently, more cheaply. I know there's that TPP,
Trans-Pacific.
Yeah, partnership.
Partnership.
That would ban anything public as being unfair competition for private companies. Well, that makes no sense. It's very fair competition. If it works better, we should have it. If it serves the people better, we should have it. I mean, it would be like saying that corporations are unfair competition for single family farms and mom and pop stores because they can get things cheaper and make things cheaper. But we consider it a virtue. If you can make things cheaper and you're more secure and you put out a better product, you win. And it's not, you know, you can't say that's unfair competition because you've hurt the big corporations. We want to hurt the big corporations.
Now, what about the other point you made earlier about just printing more money? I've heard a criticism of that point to say that it would lead to inflation when you boost the money supply and then there's basically out of proportion with goods and services available. Well, what do you say to that concern about inflation?
Well, the Chinese, when they have, before they, right now they're purporting to conform to World Trade Organization standards, so they call these non-performing loans now when they fail. But before they were operating under our system, they just advanced credit they own the industries, and so they advanced it to the industries, and they just kept track of which was profitable and which wasn't. But it was just a bookkeeping thing. And if some lost money, they didn't try to get it from somewhere else. They didn't have to get it from somewhere else. They just wrote it off, and it worked perfectly well. There was not a great, you know, it didn't turn into hyperinflation because you're going to be writing off loans anyway. So in our system right now, we have deflation. We're actually in the situation of Japan, which has had deflation for, I think, 20 years now. And they're, no matter what they do, you know, they seem to be trying to pump money into the system, and it doesn't work, and it doesn't put people back to work. It doesn't get money into the economy. It doesn't stimulate the economy. And it hasn't driven prices into inflation. In fact, they were far higher in the late 1980s before the big collapse. And we're not, people say, well, food is going up and oil is going up, and it must be because the Fed is printing money. But other things are not going up. I mean, if you look at housing relative to where it was in 2007 and wages, which are the two major components of the price structure, they are way down. So if you put all the prices together, we're still in deflation. And the reason we're in deflation is the banks are not creating as much money as they used to. They're not making as many loans as they used to. So the money is not out there competing for goods and services and stimulating the economy. So we have you can add money to the system until you're at maximum productive capacity. And it's at that point that you will actually drive up prices. In other words, adding money doesn't per se drive up prices. What it does is it puts people to work. Let's say you did like a social credit consumer dividend idea, and you just dropped $1,000 into the pockets of all the people. They would go out and spend that money, and that would create more demand. That would cause companies to hire more people to make more products. They don't raise their prices, they sell more products. That's what they want to do, sell more products. And they only raise their prices when there's a shortage, so that they, let's say it's one piece of real estate and everybody wants it, that's when the cost of the house goes up. You know, there's only one house and a lot of people competing to buy it. But if you have a lot of producers who are willing to produce the product, the price doesn't go up. You just get a lot more products. So supply goes up along with demand, and prices remain stable.
Ellen Brown, I'm wondering if in the face of these proposed changes, what kind of advice would you be inclined to recommend to concerned listeners? I know the idea of getting of bank nationalization and so on seems a little remote, but is there anything that maybe bank customers can do in the here and now, like maybe move to a smaller bank or credit union or do something else with their money?
Well, a credit union would definitely be safer because they don't gamble in derivatives. The only way that I can see that it wouldn't be safe would be if the government decided we can see now that they've changed the rules and they're going to keep changing them. So they might just come out and say, well, we're going to do haircuts to all deposits like they tried to do in Greece because, you know, we need to do it to save the big banks. But in general, certainly a credit union should be safer. Or, you know, don't necessarily keep more in the bank than you need to pay your bills for, you know, than you just need for your liquidity needs. And I don't know, I think a home safe might not be a bad idea. I saw where they can actually bust into your safety deposit box now for national security reasons. Homeland Security can do it.
Oh, wow. And
if you had a big bank collapse, that would be national security.
Ellen Brown is a Los Angeles civil litigation attorney. She's the chair of the Public Banking Institute and the author of Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. Her websites are webofdebt.com and ellenbrown.com. Ellen Brown, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. And can I throw in one more website? publicbankinginstitute.org. And we have a big conference coming up June 2nd to 4th. In San Rafael, California, and the information is on the website.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ellen Brown.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.